What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Matt Green, subject of the documentary film The World Before Your Feet, who has walked every street in New York City over the past 8 years. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and our Shinshiniot, young representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benekot. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. The word rabbi is a fancy term for teacher. The word has ancient origins and an illustrious history, but at heart, every rabbi is a kind of teacher, and our authority is based solely on our knowledge and ability to impart it. It's true that most rabbis spend a great deal of time doing other things, attending meetings, doing administrative work, filling out forms, conducting rituals, and of course services, consoling the bereaved, visiting the sick, counseling the confused, raising money, organizing or doing social action projects or programs, tweeting, recording radio shows. And these activities might not even include any actual teaching or learning. Still, being a rabbi means, in its essence, being a well-informed teacher about Judaism. I've always believed that the core responsibility of any rabbi is to teach Jewish subjects responsibly and creatively, to make the amazing storehouse, the giant cloud of Jewish wisdom, history, culture, and civilization available to everyone at whatever level he or she is capable of understanding it. That means that I always find myself overcommitted to teaching multiple classes to both adults and children and enjoying it. In a way, it becomes a kind of addiction to instruction. At times, I've found myself teaching 9 or 10 classes in different courses any given week on subjects ranging from Kabbalah to Jewish history to music to movies to Jewish poetry to Talmud to ethics to, well, you get the idea. Interestingly, the most challenging class to teach for me is not in the more advanced subjects, but it's the introductory Judaism class. This is the course that establishes the basis for many people's own Jewish identity and leads some, many, to ultimately convert to Judaism. It's challenging to teach because it requires the rabbi, the teacher, me, to explore what is truly foundational to his own Judaism and to convey that in a way that's informative, of course, but also both convincing and appealing. It's one thing to display erudition on some arcane Jewish subject, or research an interesting but obscure aspect of knowledge, say Jews in the American Civil War, or medieval Jewish theology, or the Dead Sea Scrolls, or women's prayers of request in the 17th century, and to teach that with flair. It's quite another thing to make referable everything you care about in a way that someone without much background can connect to and understand and enjoy. That's the great challenge, and the great joy of reconnecting with what really matters on a regular basis, which is precisely what responsible, inspired teaching is all about. And that is what makes teaching introductory Judaism so foundational. You have to go back to your own roots in order to help new trees grow, I think. It ain't always easy, but it is great. Of course, that's what rabbis have been doing for about 1900 years, ever since the first scholars were formally ordained as rabbis, and it's what Jewish scholars and scribes did for centuries before the title became what it has now become. And that's why being a rabbi is an incredible calling and a privilege. To play us in this morning, here's a pretty little Israeli song on a different subject, My Love, from Dudi Bar David and Roni Dalumi.
בלילות את לא נרדמת, למציאות לא מוותרת, מנסה למצוא מקור. סיפור שרק נשמע פשוט, ילדה מבית טוב, תפסה בחור ביישן מהדרום. וזה כמעט כמו סרט איטלקי, אך מזכירים לך שתדעי, אהבה זה לא הכל. בחיים כשמסתבך אז משקרים, תלרקח גם את האויב הכי גדול. שיחות עם אלוהים ליד המקרר, על קפה חד סוכר שהתקרר. My love, my love, סורי מצטער, זו מין תקופה עכשיו. בסוף נשארת האמת והיא תסתום להם את הפה לכל מי שקבע מה נועה. My love, my love, חכי שנייה ואל תלכי לי שוב עכשיו. זה מעייפתי לפעמים, אבל יודע שבפנים את הנוף הכי יפה שיש בחיים.
אז עלינו על טיסה לראות שטבע וחיות, לקחת חופש אמיתי מהדעות. זה רק נשמע מאוד יפה, אבל בפנים יש קול כזה שהוא כמו די-ג'י שמרקיד את הדעקות. אחר כך ארוחה וקצת תמונות, אבל בשורות טובות פחות, מחר תגיע השיקה. כשהתחבקנו בשדה עם הדמעות על הכס, הזכרתי פעם מילים שהאימא לאמרה. הכי חשוב שתלמדי את העיקר, לאנשים תמיד יש מה לומר. ביי לה, ביי לה, אל תגיד לי שזו תקופה עכשיו. בסוף נשארת האמת והיא תסתום להם את הפה לכל מי שקבע מה נורא. ביי לה, ביי לה, אתה הבית שאני רוצה אליו. כשנמאס לי לפעמים אני יודעת שבפנים אתה הנוף הכי יפה שיש.
סורי מצטער, זו מין תקופה עכשיו. בסוף נשארת האמת והיא תסתום להם את הפה לכל מי שקבע מה נורא.
ביי לה, ביי לה, אתה הבית שאני רוצה אליו.
כשנמאס לי לפעמים אני יודע שבפנים אתה הנוף הכי יפה שיש בחיים.
That was Dudi Bar David and Roni Dalumi singing My Love. Our guest this morning, Matt Green, is the subject of the award-nominated documentary film The World Before Your Feet. He's a Jewish guy who has walked every single street in New York City over the past 8 years, more or less. Find out why and what he's learned along the way. We'll return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Matt Green has one of the most unusual projects you will ever hear of, done by anybody Jewish or anybody. He decided to walk every single street of all of New York's boroughs, and has done so, is the subject of a fascinating documentary, World Before Your Feet, which is out and about around the country now. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, all right, the obvious question, why?
I don't know why, other than that this is kind of the culmination of some various walking projects I've done over the years. And I used to be a civil engineer. I'd sit at my desk all day and try to figure out a way to do something different with my life. And walking was the first idea that worked that got me out of the office. And so back in 2010, I quit my job and I did a walk across America. And then about a year and a half after I finished that, I started this walk around New York, which is, you know, turned out to be 7 years and counting now. And I don't know why, other than it seems to be working. It's a more fulfilling thing than anything else I've ever done. And I don't know, something inside me just told me it felt like the right thing to do.
Yeah, it may be genetic. You know, we've been called wandering Jews for a long time.
Yes.
I'm sure I'm not the first person to mention that.
No, but you are correct. There is something to that, I think. I used to lead this walking group in the city back when I was still working, and a very large proportion of the members of the group were at least 50% genetically Jewish. So there was something going on there between wandering and Jews.
Now, it's also possible, being in New York, that was just the demographics.
It was higher than you would otherwise expect.
Higher than you even would expect.
Yeah, even in New York, yeah.
So in doing this project, civil engineer is one of those good, solid, normal careers. What did your family think about it?
My family was, they certainly were concerned about me, you know, not having a kind of stable and secure life. But at the same time, you know, they knew it was important for me to find something that was meaningful for me to do with my life. And I think as time has gone on, it's become a little bit easier for them to deal with, just because, you know, nothing bad has happened over the years. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure at the same time it's harder to deal with this kind of weird lifestyle becoming almost a decade long thing at this point. But I don't know. Maybe they're resigned to it at this point.
It's a fascinating project. We will talk much more with Matt Green, who is the subject of the documentary World Before Your Feet, about this incredible walking project and some of the surprises and fulfillments and oddities of his journey, continuing journey, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills, celebrates its first services, classes, and events this winter and into the spring. Established by a group of passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Congregation Beit Simcha is dedicated to create a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. As a new progressive congregation in the foothills and northwest Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to all throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, evening and morning, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills. Our magnificent new Beit Simcha home, 3001 East Skyline Boulevards, on the northeast corner of Skyline and Campbell, across from La Encantada. Services, classes, and events are open to all. Join us this Friday night at Skyline and Campbell, Shabbat services, Friday night or at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Torah services and Torah discussion at 9 a.m. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, and our rich array of adult education academy courses, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org. That's B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675 or BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona at its wonderful beginning. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as a very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America. We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So Israel is not only successful on this planet, now it's reached out to space. We had a guy from Space IL on here as a guest not too long ago. Look, when would we think there'd be an Israeli moonshot, you know?
Right. That's really a dream come true. And it's amazing to remember and to know that it's only the fourth country that will land on the moon. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible. Fourth. Israel.
It is.
Tiny little Israel with 7.5 million people.
It's incredible. And I just read today that that Israel is actually helping a European country to reach the moon after, to be the fifth. It's amazing. It is called Genesis, the space.
The space project,
unmanned,
right?
Unmanned ship, yeah.
The unmanned moon landing. Yes. I know this has had a kind of a tremendous effect publicity-wise and within Israel in terms of catalyzing interest in science.
Started with a Google competition, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing stuff. Where does the funding come from? How does this all work?
It is government, but it's private. Oh, it's more private, but it's government too. I mean, I know some families who donated to the project.
Think about it. It's one thing to say, please come plant trees in Israel. It's another thing to say, please put an Israeli flag on the moon.
Different numbers, yes.
Yeah. It's not $18 to
correct.
Get involved in Space IL.
Correct.
What are the realistic hopes for this project? Is it scientific? Is it inspirational? What's really the purpose
of it? I believe it's both. I believe it's both. You know, everything that we do is not only one dimensional. So I think that, you know, having a statement, here we are, you know, we landed, you know, on the moon. That's amazing. It's putting the spirit of Israel together. It's educational as well, because Space IL, as you I'm sure know, and many of your listeners, is an organization that really supports and promotes education, science, you know, education. I had the honor to speak with Ilan Ramon later in Ilan Ramon before
the astronaut before he went up.
Correct.
And of course died in that tragic accident.
And I had an amazing honor to meet his widow who
passed
away.
Just died from cancer.
Ona Ramon. Right. Yes. And it was both meetings were around education and bringing Israeli education to either a school in San Francisco or to a school in Vegas at the time.
You know, one of the fascinating aspects of Israel that I think we kind of understand here, but maybe don't fully, is just how innovative Israel has become. Yeah, we remember Startup Nation a few years ago.
And right, the book too.
Everybody you talk to at Israel, their son, their grandson, their granddaughter is in high tech, or they're in high tech themselves.
Yeah. There are 40,000 Israelis in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
Last time I counted.
And of course, there's the whole Herzliya and the high tech pods in the Galilee.
Correct.
And all around Israel.
Correct.
Now. Can we expect an Israeli space industry to come out of this? Is that a little bit too much to ask?
Well, we actually do have something. You know, we have a government agency that deals with space. We do have that. But I'm sure that, you know, really, you know, and it's not corny to say, that, you know, out there there's a little child, you know, a boy or a girl who will look at the moon and say, wow, Israel reached that. And regardless if they're Israelis, Jewish, anywhere in the world or not, you know, and that will inspire them, you know, to invest in education.
Extraordinary and remarkable. Thanks so much. And they're leaving from Florida, aren't they?
Yes, they're already there. Bereshit, Genesis.
We'll talk next week. Thanks, Amir.
Thanks.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We were talking last week about education, the Talmudic principle, Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, which shows up in the Mishnah and the Gemara many times. The study of Torah is equal to all the other mitzvot, all the other commandments. So what does Talmud Torah really mean? We know there's a Jewish commitment to learning, but what does it mean in this context, and how does it apply? How do we apply it?
Well, I think that's a very important, complex, and multifaceted question. First of all, Talmud Torah used to be the name of a Hebrew school.
Yeah.
You'd go to a Talmud Torah. It was a place, actually. And it was a place where you learned Torah, which meant the Hebrew alphabet. It meant blessings. It meant lots of things that aren't in the Torah by any stretch of the imagination, but that maybe stem from the Torah or reflect the values of the Torah. So then when I teach at the university and students, particularly non-Jewish students, ask what we mean by Torah, I give them the image of a pond into which you drop a stone, and there are concentric circles of ripples. And the narrowest sense of Torah is those scrolls that we keep in the ark on parchment in front of every synagogue.
A Torah.
Those are the five books of Moses, and that is a Torah. So studying Torah could be narrowly construed as just studying those words on that parchment. But we also know that we have the Tanakh, the whole Hebrew Bible, which is Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim, So that's Torah, the five books of Moses, then all the books of the prophets and a few others, and then all the books like Psalms and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, the sort of later books that are all part of what we consider holy scriptures. So the second ripple for me is the Tanakh as a whole, of which Torah is the first and arguably most holy part. But then there's also the concept of Torah she'bal peh, the oral law, which is Mishnah and Gemara, or combined the Talmud, which have in practice the standing of Jewish law. They're equal to Torah. They were just revealed later and in a different way.
Derived, if you will, from the original revelation.
Right. So that's also Torah. Then this question of, is anything else Torah? Well, if you read a page of Talmud, there's the Rishonim and the Acharonim, and there's all kinds of even later commentators in the Acharonim. There are commentators from the 18th, 19th, 20th century whose words also constitute words of Torah. I mean, I think there's hardly anyone who would argue that Heschel didn't speak words of Torah.
Sure, sure.
So if we take Torah in this very broad sense, do we dilute it to a point where it's meaningless? I think not, and I'll give you a very precise example in next week's show.
Thanks, Tom. We will continue to explore Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam and its implications for all of us.
I look forward to it.
Thanks. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Becky, Rivka, and Estelle are passing by the half-open door to the men's changing rooms at the golf club when they can't help noticing a man with his face obscured by a towel he is using to dry his hair. They do, however, get a good view of his nakedness from the waist down. Becky says, "Well, I didn't see his face, but he's certainly not my husband." Rivka says, "He isn't mine either." And Estelle says, "Heck, he's not even a member of the club." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shiniyot, our young representatives of Israel representing the Weintraub Israel Center, Ron Benakot and Rotem Rappaport, on behalf of Israel. You just came back from there, but I think you are thinking a lot, not just about your experience here in America as representatives of Israel and this gap year, but about what it's like to go into the army. And I know that you're probably a little nervous about that. Tell us a little bit about what that feels like. Not everybody has had that experience.
Right. So we are a little bit nervous about that. But obviously, it's an experience that everyone, almost everyone in Israel, are going to have. And with this nerve that I have, I'm also really excited about that. Just to get a good position and to meet new people, get into a new way in my life that, who knows, maybe we'll get me to somewhere amazing eventually.
Well, certainly it's going to be different, isn't it?
Yeah.
I hear this rumor that the night before you go in, nobody sleeps a wink. Is that something you've heard too?
I never heard of that. I don't know. I just think that... Really? I just think that...
I see a little disagreement going on here. Some of you have heard of it. Okay, go ahead.
I just think that people... There's a lot of people that get nervous. It's common, and I think it makes sense, but also because everyone has that, not everyone, but almost everyone has that experience. Some people don't really think about it that as in a nervous way, but more of a
excited.
Yeah, like sort of a life path, like another step, you know.
It's such a normal thing. So many people do. I mean, virtually every guy and really almost all the young women outside of the Haredi community, the ultra-Orthodox community in Israel, serves in the military. Are you going to be in a different position having spent this year as Shin Shiniyot, you know, doing your Shnat Sherut, your year of service to Israel? You're now like a year older than some of the people going in?
So we are going to be a year older than all the people that was in our class when we got there. And when we got here, I'm sorry. And it's it's going to be a little bit different just because some of our supervisors could be younger than us and it would be a little bit different.
Yeah, that's going to be strange.
Yeah, it will. And after being a year far from your home and independence, like, you're in a position where you have to listen to other people and to be more strict about all the rules. And I bet it's going to be a great experience.
So any, I know you still have a little time. You have months actually to go, but you'll start in the summer or the fall. Sort of when do you actually begin? Do you know yet?
So I hopefully will recruit in August.
Does that mean that's when you go in? That when you say recruit, you do your testing in advance and then you basically start basic training in August?
Yeah, I'm supposed to go, like, my first day is supposed to be in August.
Wow. And you?
And for me, it's not really, I'm not really sure. It depends on my job, but sometime in September and October
sometime
of 2018.
Listen, it's exciting stuff. It'll be a wonderful new stage in your lives to judge from the other Shinshinim that we've had here. But thank you, Ron and Rotem, for sharing some of your own feelings and thoughts on this big move that's coming up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Tetzaveh in the book of Exodus, a ritually oriented parsha which gives the commandment to create a Ner Tamid, an eternal light, for the tabernacle in the wilderness. The tabernacle was the first sanctuary of the people of Israel, although, technically speaking, the tabernacle, the Mishkan, was a very elaborate portable tent. It was also the place where God's presence in the form of the Shekhinah resided. In a sense, that's where God lived, or more accurately, since God is, of course, everywhere, it was where God was most available to us. Last week in Truma, our ancestors were asked to create this sacred space through the voluntary gifts of their hearts. This week we're told that there should be a continual fire, a Ner Tamid, a constant light shining on the altar, sign of God's faithful and permanent presence in our midst. Revealingly, that light is to be created and kindled by us, not God. We must build the altar and the fire and continue to feed and nurture it to keep it alive. If you have ever kept a fire burning round the clock, say at a camp out or bonfire, or for heat on a cold winter's night in some frigid clime, you know just how much fuel you need to do it. You're always either stoking it or bringing in more wood for it to burn. If neglected for any length of time, it simply burns out. The Ner Tamid was therefore not just a symbol, but a process, requiring regular care and feeding to flourish. Our spiritual lives are rather like that ancient Ner Tamid. If we wish God's presence to illuminate our lives, to give us warmth and comfort, then we too must feed our own Ner Tamid, must gently and regularly add spiritual fuel to the flame. Religious experiences, prayer, meditation, introspection, blessings, personal and communal rituals, time for breathing and allowing God into our lives, all of these help feed the fire. And they must be done with regularity, or our own internal, eternal lights will go out. The Ner Tamid, that ancient light, is found today in every synagogue in the world, no matter how humble the shul or how grand the temple. While today we simply pay the electric bills to keep the Ner Tamid alive, even that requires a bit of active participation, but its symbolic purpose is much greater. The Ner Tamid burns always to remind us God is with us always if we take the time to feed our own spiritual fires regularly. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Matt Green, whose mission it is to walk every single street of all five boroughs of New York City, will explain what he has learned on this remarkable journey. He's the subject of a wonderful documentary, The World Before Your Feet. And Matt will also tell us what a nice Jewish young man is doing spending all that time wandering New York. Hear more of his extraordinary story when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Aseinu, aseinu,
There was a tragic loss for the Jewish people last week. Rabbi Yechiel Eckstein died of a heart attack at the age of 67. Eckstein was a man of vision whose enormous drive to succeed facilitated his relentless efforts on behalf of the whole Jewish people and of saving endangered Jews and feeding those who needed it. Rabbi Eckstein was twice a guest of Two Jewish and the co-winner of the 2016 Kohan Memorial Foundation Award for his work rescuing Jews around the world. As head of the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, or IFCJ, the New York-born Eckstein raised hundreds of millions of dollars in donations, mostly from Christians, for projects benefiting needy Jews and Arabs in Israel and beyond. The largest private charity operating in Israel, IFCJ, known in Hebrew as Keren Yedidut, currently raises about $140 million a year. To many thousands of ordinary Jews and Christians whose lives he touched without ever meeting them, Eckstein was a guardian angel. Heading a powerful machine that offered everyday assistance and was able to intervene quickly in emergencies, in creative ways, cutting through the red tape characteristic of so many other aid groups. The impact left by Yechiel Eckstein, who died of cardiac arrest at his home in Jerusalem, was reflected in the glowing eulogies mainstream Jewish groups offered within hours of his death. He was a tireless worker for the Jewish people and for Israel. He made significant contributions by fostering evangelical support for Israel, said Jonathan Greenblatt, national director of the ADL. Yechiel Eckstein grew up in Canada and moved to Israel, making Aliyah in 1999. He began his involvement in interfaith dialogue with the ADL in 1974. He started the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews in 1983. Using TV advertising, his own charisma, and tireless outreach legwork throughout the U.S., Eckstein made unprecedented headway raising funds for Israel and Jews in crisis situations among evangelical Christians. He also pushed back against Jewish leaders who distrusted evangelical support of Israel. The majority of evangelicals are passionately pro-Israel because it is part of their theology to love and support the Jewish people, Eckstein wrote in 2002. I could not accept the conditional love of those who expect a payback on behalf of my people. I could not embark on a relationship that would compromise my personal integrity and ideals or that of the Jewish community I represent. But having been the first, and often the only, Jew to build bridges with the right-wing Christian community, I have a view and understanding of their pro-Israel fervor that most people on the outside lack. Israel's influential Tzohar rabbinical group called him a visionary whose leadership enabled tremendous support for the state and people of Israel, and his actions bettered the lives of countless people all over the country. Isaac Herzog, the chairman of the Jewish Agency, said that the Jewish people have lost a leader who worked tirelessly on their behalf. Eckstein was ordained at Yeshiva University in New York, held master's degrees from Yeshiva University and Columbia University, where he also completed studies for his doctorate. One of his three daughters, Yael, is the global executive vice president of the IFCJ. Despite the posthumous embrace, Eckstein had a thorny relationship with the Jewish establishment many places he went. Critics considered him a manipulator of public opinion with a temper and an overgrown ego. Most recently, he clashed publicly with the Jewish Agency, to which his group has donated many millions of dollars over the years. The funding stopped in 2014 amid a fight over recognition for the International Federation of Christians and Jews by the agency, and Eckstein's long-held reservations about its efficiency in fulfilling its primary task, fulfilling the immigration of Jews to Israel, Aliyah. Eckstein had the International Federation of Christians and Jews start its own Aliyah operation in 2014. It offered every new immigrant a $1,000 grant on top of the benefits offered by the Jewish Agency. He helped bring thousands of immigrants from Ukraine during its conflict with Russia to Israel, as well as bringing to Israel Jews from France, Venezuela, Yemen, and other trouble spots. It was Eckstein's outreach to Christians, however, that initially made him a pariah for many years to Israel's Rabbanut, the chief rabbinate, which is, frankly, an extreme organization controlled by the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox. In 2001, Israel's then chief Ashkenazi rabbi, Avraham Shapira, published a letter condemning Eckstein's use of Christian money to expand Christian missionary propaganda. Rabbi Yosef Shalom Elyashiv, an influential Haredi Talmud scholar, signed a letter forbidding cooperation with Eckstein, calling it close to idolatry. Eckstein dismissed the chief rabbinate's attacks as not worthy of response. He angered some of his nationalist critics as well in Israel with his group's millions of dollars of support for impoverished Israeli Arabs, Christians, and Muslims. Yechiel Eckstein never let selfish opposition get in the way of doing the right thing to save lives and help the Jews. Despite repeated conflicts over the years with establishment figures, the scale of Eckstein's work made his organization too big to ignore, forcing even his most outspoken critics to work with him. Thanks to Eckstein, today so many Christians from around the world stand in fellowship with Israel, Rabbi Tuli Weiss said, an author and publisher of the Israeli National News. We, Jews and Christians together, mourn the tragic loss of a true bridge builder. May his memory continue to bring blessing as his organization does. The number of anti-Semitic incidents recorded in the United Kingdom rose to 1,652 in 2018, a new record for the third straight year, and not a good one. The cases recorded in the annual report of the Community Security Trust, which is British Jewry's largest watchdog on anti-Semitism, represented a 16% increase over 2017. The report did show a 17% decrease in the number of violent anti-Semitic assaults, down to 123, still far too many from 149 in the previous year. The most common single type of incident in 2018 was verbal abuse randomly directed at visibly Jewish people in public, accounting for 29% of the annual count. In 500 cases recorded last year, witnesses gave descriptions of the perpetrators, and among them, 64% were described as Europeans, 37% as Arab, South Asian, or Black. When there was public debate about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, there was also an increase in anti-Semitic incidents. There were 148 anti-Semitic incidents directly linked to the Labour Party in Britain last year. Anti-Semitic acts have been recorded in Great Britain since 1984. The number of incidents has more than tripled in the last 5 years. And finally, President Donald Trump is set to name Los Angeles prosecutor Elon Carr to be the State Department's envoy for anti-Semitism, filling a post that has been empty for 2 years despite protests from lawmakers and Jewish groups. Elon Carr is 50 years old, a U.S. Army veteran who served in Iraq and was national president of the Jewish fraternity Alpha Epsilon Pi. He is a respected criminal prosecutor in L.A. We eagerly look forward to working with Carr as his office combats rising anti-Semitism generated from the far right, the far left, and Islamist extremists, and abetted by the ubiquitous nature of social media, said David Harris, the American Jewish Committee's CEO. Carr is plunging immediately into his work, heading this week to a conference on anti-Semitism in Bratislava organized by Slovakia, which currently chairs the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And then he'll go to a European Union conference on anti-Semitism in Brussels. Carr has met or planned meetings with predecessors from both Republican and Democratic administrations. Multiple letters from Jewish groups and a bipartisan array of congressional members have urged Trump to fill the post. His failure until now to name an anti-Semitism envoy exacerbated concerns in the Jewish community about the president's attitude towards anti-Semitism. Trump has equivocated on condemning white supremacists who endorse and praise him. He has cultivated relationships with authoritarians around the globe, including many who are close with the far right, particularly in Hungary. The U.S. House last month overwhelmingly approved a bill elevating the anti-Semitism position to the ambassadorial level. A 2004 law established the post originally. Elon Carr was national president of AEPI from 2012 to 2014 during its centennial year as a fraternity. In the interest of full disclosure, I was an AEPI at UCLA, later served as a chapter advisor. My son is an AEPI now at Arizona State. Ambassador Carr was a member while attending UC Berkeley and Northwestern. He has a mixed Mizrahi-Ashkenazi Jewish background and is best known for organizing a Hanukkah celebration in Saddam Hussein's palace when he was in the U.S. Army. His appointment has received widespread support throughout the American Jewish world. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Matt Green, has one of the most unusual projects you will ever hear of. We spoke a little bit earlier in the show. There's a documentary on him called The World Before Your Feet. His project is to walk every single street of all of New York's five boroughs, and he's been on this now for 7 years. It almost sounds, you know, kind of biblical at this point.
Well, thank you. I think that's a compliment.
It is. Coming from a rabbi, that's got to be a compliment. What's the weirdest thing that's happened to you?
You know, a lot of times I'll get questions about what's, you know, the most this or that. And there's a certain aspect of this walk that's really not about looking backward and ranking things that have happened, because the whole nature of the walk is that it's a very forward-looking thing, because every block that you're on is kind of a block you're checking off, and you're moving on to the next block and the next block and the next block. And so I don't spend a whole lot of time, you know, looking back, remembering, comparing this to that. There's something about the structure of the walk that just kind of keeps me moving forward, keeps me focused on where I am and the next thing coming up. So and also it's been 7+ years now, and, you know, I can't remember everything that's happened to me. It's, you know, it's almost like a lifetime.
Kind of, you know, and obviously there's the constant question of what's coming up around the next corner, which any of us who love to journey are always excited about seeing. So the practical question, here you are walking out in Staten Island. Where do you crash? How do you figure out where you're staying from place to place?
Well, I always have places to stay lined up, usually a week or two ahead of time. Yeah, I guess I should mention that I don't have an apartment.
Right.
You know, that's part of how I make the finances work on this. If I had to pay rent, I would just go bankrupt and, you know, that would be the end of it. But by not paying rent, I can basically stretch out my tiny amount of income combined with my savings from my engineering days. So, you know, I usually have places to stay lined up a week or two ahead of time. And sometimes that means I'm just asking friends, hey, on the, you know, 20th, 21st, 22nd, can I come crash on your couch? Or sometimes it's people saying to me, hey, we're going to be out of town the first 2 weeks in April. Can you come watch our cat when we're gone? And, you know, or can you come water our plants when we're gone? Or, like, you know, sometimes just we'll be gone. You want to come stay at the house then? So it's a whole kind of combination of different reasons for being places. And I had mentioned that that walking group that I used to lead earlier. When I started this walk, I was thinking, oh, maybe I can, you know, with all the people I met through that group who are interested in walking, who are probably sympathetic to what I'm doing, I can probably patch together enough places to stay for a couple years, because that's how long I thought it was going to take me at the beginning. And then over time, people asked me to watch their cats, and I started to realize how great of an opportunity that is to kind of have your own place for a week or two. And then, you know, their friends would need someone to watch their cat and they'd recommend me. And so that network's kind of grown over the years. And it's made it possible to do this for 7+ years now without having anywhere to stay.
Do you think that there's something intrinsic in sort of, I mean, you have a lot of time to think, right, when you're walking? I know you meet people, but I mean, you obviously have a lot of time alone. Do you think there's something intrinsic about that feeling of motion, like it's just a human need?
Yeah, that's a very perceptive question, I think, because I didn't think that was the case earlier on. You know, if you'd asked me some kind of question like that, I would have probably thought you were overthinking things. You know, I thought of walking as just this great way to be exploring the world, which puts it very much in the context of where you're walking. You know, that the experience of walking is primarily related to where you're walking. But over the years, I've realized that that's not necessarily true, you know. Exploring the specific place where you are is a big part of walking. But I agree that there's something intrinsic about just the act of walking as a human, you know, the act of just passing through space, basically, being in motion, you know, having your body in motion. There's something about that, you know, even if you were in a pitch black place where you couldn't see anything, that there's something fulfilling about just moving and progressing somewhere. And I don't know exactly what it is, but I think at the end of a day of walking, you know, you walk 18 miles and you just feel good at the end of that day. Your body feels good and you feel like you've accomplished something, I think, independent of where you were, what you saw, who you met, all those kind of things.
Different direction. Did you ever think you would be the subject of a documentary?
No, I never thought I'd be the subject of a documentary. I had had a couple people earlier on in my walk, people I didn't really know, hear about what I was doing and propose the idea of coming out and filming stuff. And it never really felt right, because I think, you know, most people's perception of a walk like this is that it's about, you know, finding the best of New York City, you know, kind of reducing New York to some lists and having the movie be about what's the craziest this, the craziest that, you know, the best this, the worst that. And that just didn't feel like what the walk was to me at all. You know, wasn't, as I said before, wasn't about ranking things or kind of turning the city into a more easily digestible form of itself. It was, you know, the walk to me is about embracing how overwhelming the city is and the understanding that, you know, no matter how much you walk around, you're never really going to know that much about the city. It's always going to be much bigger than you are. And then about 2.5 years after I'd started walking, my friend Jeremy Workman, who I'd known for a number of years, he just asked me if he could come walk with me one day and bring his camera along. And there was never any grand plan to make a movie or anything. And there was no, you know, obligation to keep doing it. So, you know, knowing him and knowing his previous work and understanding that this, you know, this guy was kind of seeing this project in the same way I was, gave me the confidence to say, sure, why don't you come out with me and, you know, let's just see what it looks like. And I was curious to see, you know, what he could capture on film that I wasn't capturing myself. You know, there's my blog is very kind of based on the things that I see and what I learn about them, but it doesn't capture the experience of walking itself, you know, what that's like, what it's like meeting people. So I knew that there was this cool part of my walk that I wasn't capturing at all. And knowing that, you know, I had a good friend who saw things the same way I did, who maybe would be capable of capturing that, made me interested in having him along with me. And so he came out one day and he filmed, and then he came out another day and another day, and ended up doing that on and off for about 3.5 years. And, you know, he captured 500, 600 hours of footage. And he somehow shaped it into this film that really resonates with a lot of how it feels to do the walk. And a lot of the themes of the walk come through it, even though we didn't discuss them explicitly in a lot of cases. And so that was something that really impressed me about him and about his filmmaking, that he was able to kind of just get inside the walk and give you the experience of this walk without me just standing there talking about these things to the camera. You know, he just kind of came out with me and just observed and filmed and, you know, never tried to force anything. And eventually really did capture this pretty natural portrait of what it's like.
I have a very Jewish question. Did anybody ever try to draft you to participate in a minyan when you're walking through one of the Jewish neighborhoods?
No one's ever tried to draft me to participate in a minyan. I've gotten asked a couple times. This, you know, doesn't have to do with me looking Jewish, but I have gotten asked a couple times by some Orthodox families to come in and, you know, turn an air conditioner on, turn a light on,
to be their Shabbat, to be their Shabbos goy, yeah.
To be the Shabbos goy, even though, I mean, I'm 50% goy genetically, so,
right, so you got it.
So,
covered.
You know, I just use that side of me in those instances. But yeah, you know, and then I've told friends about that, and, you know, that's happened to them too. And it's funny, you know, you live in New York enough times, you kind of, that happens to you, you know. It's a neat thing because it's this way of getting invited in to this very intimate part of this family's existence. You know, they have to just have a stranger come right into their house and do something for them. And especially in the, you know, in the case of a Hasidic community that might be, you know, somewhat more closed off than other communities would be to the modern world. It's really neat to have that opportunity where they have to kind of reach out to people who aren't like them and say, can you come in and just help me right now? So those are always very unique and memorable experiences.
You know, your walk kind of makes walking the Appalachian Trail pale in comparison. You know, any of the great walks that people go on, the pilgrimages that they take. Is this a kind of a pilgrimage for you, do you think?
Yeah, I do think it's a kind of a pilgrimage. I mean, I don't even know that I know exactly what a pilgrimage is, but somehow that term kind of has started to resonate with me. I think there's a, you know, an aspect of the walk that is, it's certainly motivated by something beyond a particular earthly goal. There's really no earthly goal to this. I don't think there's an actual particular point to what I'm doing. I'm not accomplishing anything particular. You know, there's no prize at the end of the walk. And so there's definitely some kind of motivation there that goes beyond those kind of things. And I think it's beyond my ability to understand or talk about even. There's just something deep inside me that's calling me to do this. And so, I think in that way it is kind of like a pilgrimage to whatever extent I even understand what a pilgrimage is.
You know, it's like that old cliche, life is a journey. Your life really is a journey and has been now for 7 years. And
it is. I think that's true of everybody, though. You know, sometimes it's just more obvious because I'm on a more literal journey. But, you know, I think when we look back on life, we always realize life's always, you know, the thing that happens when you're on the way to somewhere else.
Right.
You know,
life is what happens to you when you're busy making other plans.
Yes, that's the quote. Thank you.
John Lennon, there you go. Sorry.
Yes, okay. Someone mentioned that the other day, and I couldn't remember who it was who said it, so thank you.
A lot of people have said it a lot of different ways. He just sang it.
Yeah,
better.
Yeah, right. Right.
Well, here's the funny question, and I'm sure it's been asked, but when you finish New York, which sounds like a ridiculous thing to say on so many levels, but when you, when you, and I don't know which parts of the city you haven't finished yet, but when you complete that, what follows when you're done?
Well, to answer the second part first, the parts that are left are actually all scattered about the city, just a handful of days here and there scattered around, which is a result of how I walk the city because I'm staying in so many different apartments. You know, I'll walk whatever areas closest to me that I haven't walked when I'm staying in those places. So as a result, the map was filled in a very scattershot fashion. And likewise, there's just, you know, arbitrary bits and pieces here and there scattered around the city. You know, one day of walking left here in southern Staten Island, one day over here on the west side, you know. But yeah, after I am finished, in whatever sense you could ever be finished, I don't know what's next. I honestly have no idea. I've been interested in figuring out some kind of educational thing to do with this walk. You know, I've been going into different schools and talking to kids there of different grade levels and in some instances doing walks with kids where we go out and just like walk literally just the block that the school is on. And, you know, any block in New York City, you can see so many things and bring up so many subjects from all the stuff that normally goes overlooked. You know, you see a fire hydrant on the block, and that lets you talk about not just, you know, firefighting and how that all works, but, you know, where does the water for the fire hydrant come from? Oh, it comes from, you know, 100 plus miles away from the Catskill Mountains, just flowing under the force of gravity all the way down in the city. You know, you see see some kind of plant growing in a sidewalk crack, and that gives you the opportunity to talk about plant life in New York City, which is, you know, not something you'd think of as a top topic for
New
York.
Tree grows in Brooklyn, you know,
exactly.
There's a tremendous amount of flora all over in New York City.
Exactly. I mean, every block in New York City is an ecosystem, basically. So yeah, that whole educational component is something I've been thinking a lot more about, and, you know, whether that could turn into a full-time thing I do next or just something I occasionally do, you know, on and off over the years, I'm not sure. But that's something I've been thinking about. But yeah, I definitely don't have any one particular plan for what to do next.
I want to thank Matt Green for a great visit here on Too Jewish. I really want to find out what you do next, although I'm enjoying what you're doing now. The documentary is called The World Before Your Feet. It's terrific. Where can people go to follow your blog?
They can follow my blog at imjustwalkin.com, see all of the many detailed and tedious things I write about from day to day. So you can enjoy that. It's a good bedtime reading. It'll put you to sleep. And yeah, the movie is playing in theaters still, and it comes out on like iTunes and cable on demand on February 12th.
Terrific. I want to thank you again, Matt. This is great, and we'll keep following you.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Good talking to you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be one of the great biblical scholars in the entire world, Professor Richard Elliot Friedman, author of Who Wrote the Bible and many other works. He wrote the new book, The Exodus, How It Happened and Why It Mattered. Find out. can't wait to talk to him. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our 2JewishRadio.com website, top 10 Jewish radio show in America. Our playout this morning comes from Nasreen Kadri, Yishma Ha'el, God will hear. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
כל כך הרבה כבישים בדרך אל מקום שהוא בערך.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.